Welcome to Few and Far Between, Conversations about Rare Disease Research. I'm your host, Wayne Bowden. On today's podcast, I will be discussing how patient communities can be leveraged in rare disease studies with my guest, Julie Walters. She's the founder and executive director of Experiome. Julie started her scientific career in London with a degree in molecular genetics from King's College of London. There, she studied under the mentorship of Maurice Wilkins. Maurice Wilkins is actually a Nobel Prize laureate known for his work on the structure of DNA. Spoiler alert, it's a double helix. She later unearthed an unmet need in the rare disease space when working with various advocacy groups and sponsors in the space in the UK, and ultimately founded RareMark Patient Network, which is a community platform designed to record and share the collective experiences of rare disease patients, and also at the same time, connect those patients to clinical research opportunities, including pharma. So it's a very interesting conversation. I think you'll like it. And without further ado, here is Julie Walters. All right. I am here with Julie Walters. Julie, welcome to the Few and Far Between podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks for being here. So I know that you've done a lot of things and are doing a lot of things in rare disease, but I thought maybe we could start the conversation with a little bit about your origin story. I understand you're born in Australia, which is interesting in its own right. So maybe you can talk a little about, you know, your beginnings and how that may have shaped, you know, what you're doing now with rare diseases.
So yes, I was born in Australia some time ago. And, you know, in my family, like so many families, so members of the family, my stepbrother has autism, which may well be something else, but it's the label that we give it. My husband's sister had schizophrenia, and my father died of idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, which is one of those 7,000 rare conditions. So the point I'm trying to say is that rare disease is actually quite common. And so that was my family experience. My father died in 2010. And like so many with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, you know, he lived for 3 years post-diagnosis. And we as a family were just completely reliant on my father telling us, you know, what was idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis? Because we'd never heard of it. Why would you? You know, what did it mean? And he was completely reliant on his clinician. Now, he may have been lucky and had a clinician who was really well informed, who went to all the medical conferences. Perhaps he was recruiting to a clinical trial because it was in the years before the first antifibrotics were launched in 2014 for IPF. But we didn't know. So that was really the beginning for me. I was a journalist by training. I started at the West Australian newspaper in Perth, you know, one of the most isolated cities in the world, I think, if not the most. Then came to Fleet Street. I used to produce Good Morning Television in Britain. You know, Good Morning America is the same show, different accents. Did a degree in molecular genetics along the way to think I could, you know, try and cure cancer, and then realized it was that combination of those skills that I was, you know, pretty uniquely positioned to try and make a difference in rare disease.
That's really an excellent story. And it's interesting that you said it that way, because it's something that we've often experienced, like with some patient or some families, rare diseases just aren't rare because, like you said, each disease is so rare, but there's like 7,000 of them. So actually, I think 1 in 10, for example, Americans suffer from a rare disease. So it's actually a lot more common than you think. I'm blessed because I don't have any in mind, but I know that some families have multiple members of their family that have rare diseases. So your experience with your dad, you know, is a really interesting story. And so maybe you can talk a little bit how that then, I guess, you know, metamorphosed into what you're doing now with RareMark, and how you said your father and your family was completely reliant on his doctor, right, to get information about what IPF was, what are the available treatments, what available trials, if any, you know, for experimental drugs, you know. So how has that sort of led you to your discovery and your entrepreneurship with RareMark, and what is RareMark?
So I wasn't sure what to do with that experience, apart from, you know, being very sad when my dad died. And then many years later, I was working with some big pharmaceutical companies in Switzerland, and I was helping them just as a former senior journalist, just to get their stories out into the public domain, or even just to communicate internally about what was coming down the pipe and why that was interesting and exciting. And through that experience, I kind of stumbled into clinical trial recruitment, into development, And I was just gobsmacked, really, to understand that most clinical trial recruitment was through clinicians. And this was in a, you know, in about 15 years ago, when we then kind of had about 1 billion people online, but enough. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my observation was, but that's crazy. You know, there's 1 billion people out there searching desperately for information. I mean, it's nuts to just rely on clinicians. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. Can you do anything about that?
Yeah.
And that was when I thought, okay, all right, I think I actually have something to add here. So my communications training, I had to learn about software engineering and start to work, you know, in those days, 10 to 15 years ago, I did some of the first direct-to-patient. So it would be sponsored by a pharmaceutical company. We would put it into 28 languages, and then we would recruit patients to clinical trials. Mm-hmm. And that worked. It was slow and it was clunky, and we had to go through many layers of bureaucracy to get it live. Mm-hmm. What we realized then was that when the trial finished, then the sponsor said, okay, now take it down, take the site down, because, you know, it's going to be 2 years before commercial figure out the positioning of the drug. We'd say, but there's 500,000 people on that site, mm-hmm. learning about the condition. And so that was the aha. It was like, okay, okay, we need someone who can go beyond the trial. We need mm-hmm. someone who can stay with the patient community. Mm-hmm. You know, we often at RareMark, we start in development, just because, you know, with the 7,000 rare diseases, we have to choose where we play because we have limited resources. Mm-hmm. And so we choose therapeutic areas where we know pharma is active. And mm-hmm. sponsors tend to move as a pack. Something will happen. There'll be a new mechanism of action. There'll be something that gets the field to move. And so they tend to move together. So there's normally at least 3 or 4 sponsors mm-hmm. in the space where we launch. And then we stay with the patient community through development and into commercial. So we're with them for the journey in a way that pharma can't fall, you know, I mean, they do so much, but they can't, for whatever reason, be there for that journey.
Right. So you really do offer that consistent connection to the patients for those diseases across different trials. I remember reading this Forbes article that had you featured on it with RareMark, and they called it, or maybe you called it, the Facebook of rare diseases. So is it like that? I mean, is it actually like a Facebook in the sense mm-hmm. that patients can post their own things? There's, you know, I haven't actually been able to attend the site, but is it similar to that setup with Facebook?
Yeah, great question. They came up with that. They called it the Facebook of rare disease. And I think it is in some way like Facebook in that it's a community where people can share experience. Mm-hmm. But what we found was that every patient community has a private Facebook channel mm-hmm. where they share day-to-day experience. You know, it could be anything from, you know, that the washing machine broke, you know, the cat died, all that day-to-day emotional experience, but it wasn't structured or searchable in any way. So where we think of RareMark is a bit like a structured Facebook. Mm-hmm. So we ask questions that we know are important to the community and they're important to pharma. So for example, for pharma, like, where are you based is really important. Do you know your subset? You know, is there an antibody for your condition? That's important. Mm-hmm. Time from diagnosis is important. So we ask those questions along the journey, not all at the same time, mm-hmm. because that's just rude. And why would you answer that? And also at the same time, give them things that's helpful for them. So, you know, a lot of what's important to patients, like in sickle cell, thinking about, you know, how do you tell your partner in life that you have a long-term chronic condition? Mm-hmm. Like, that's really important to mm-hmm. them. It's not important to pharma, but it's important to them.
Yeah.
So we can ask that question of the patient community when you aggregate that experience and share it back with them. Mm-hmm. So that's the engagement piece. And we learned through the experience of giants like patients like me that came before us, that the key is not to find people, actually finding the hard to reach online is reasonably straightforward if you know what you're doing, but keeping them is the real challenge. That's the much harder piece, and that's mm-hmm. where we've spent a lot of time thinking about how do we keep people over time. And so that's the stickiness, is that mm-hmm. day-to-day life hacks, as we call them.
What is the scale of RareMark now? How many users are there on the system? You know, what is the makeup? Also, I'm interested, like, what is the makeup of the site? Is it primarily patients, or are there also, obviously, I'd imagine patient family members, but there are also providers, you know, like you mentioned pharma. So maybe you can talk about kind of what's the girth of this thing, and then what is the makeup of it as well?
So it's patients and carers. Mm. That's it. So we've written it in a way that's particularly for them because they have different needs. So we have about 150,000 members at the moment. We're only in 10 conditions. Mm-hmm. And we've chosen those 10 very carefully, as I said, because that's where pharma is most active. But we have now, we've spent 4 years figuring out what's sticky, figuring out, you know, a pediatric, late onset, a lung condition, a blood condition, figuring out what are the differences and what are the similarities. So we can scaling to another 40 conditions this year, mm-hmm. and then we can scale to 100. Like, we've built the platform and figured out how to make it scalable. So it's just for patients and carers to share their experience. And then how we engage with pharma, so that's RareMark, that's the online publication, if you like. It's like, that's the Facebook in rare disease. And then the company's called Experio now. So we've changed the name because pharma would come to RareMark and think, well, this is not for me. And we say, no, it's not. However, that patient intelligence is really what you need. So Experiome, the company, is we would engage with pharma. So say they needed to recruit to a clinical trial in myasthenia gravis. Mm-hmm. And we've recruited to, I think, 7 trials in myasthenia gravis over the last few years because they all move together. You know, pharma would contract with Experiome. We would put the ethics pack together. We would decide which geographic regions. And then we would invite patients to consider that opportunity, that research opportunity, while they're in the kind of Facebook RareMark environment, which is where the trust is, where we've built a relationship over time, where they're far more likely to consider it than if they just see something appear on a, you know, on a Google ad, mm-hmm. you know, because we have that built that trust over time. So we pre-screen them and then refer them to the trial site. So that's the methodology, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's clear what the patients are getting from RareMark is that information, that connectivity, information about what trials are out there, potentially all that good stuff that they can have consistently throughout their whole life, you know, hopefully as you grow this platform into more diseases. What sponsors can get out of that is they can get consistent access into that patient population, and they can then get that feedback, right? Because mm-hmm. so much of, I think, rare disease development right now is focused on, you know, how do I get to know this patient population when no one studied it? You know, nobody right. studied this population before. The population itself is very heterogeneous. That's what makes these trials so difficult. So any information that you can get, you know, feedback you can get on your study, potentially design, those are the sorts of things that potentially sponsors can get out of Experiome. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. That's exactly right.
So what have you seen in terms of engagement on the sponsor side? Are they contracting with Experiome to actually identify patients for trials? Or is it more of where you're pre-identifying patients, you're getting them funneled into sites, or is it more on the front end of just, you know, feedback on protocol, feedback on design, you know, overall feedback from the patient groups, or both?
Great question. I mean, because we wait till there's several sponsors in kind of phase two, mm-hmm. phase three, it's mainly on finding patients for trials. Mm-hmm. And we're still working with innovators and pioneers. I would say a lot of that sponsors have not tried this yet, this mm-hmm. direct-to-patient methodology, which has been around for about, I'd say, 10 to 15 years now. And some of them have tried it and had their fingers burned because some of the early providers in the space mm-hmm. were not necessarily pre-screening the patients carefully enough. So there's a few magic ingredients that need to work for this methodology of direct-to-patient. One of them is that the handover of the patient details to the site or the CRO has to be handled very carefully. Mm-hmm. Firstly, they need to be followed up within 48 hours because they have made a big commitment to even inquire about this trial. Mm-hmm. And they're a consumer, like they expect you to be responsive. And I think sometimes in the early days, it was so bureaucratic between the site, the sponsor, and the CRO, and patients were just lost in the system. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, there has been a lot of learnings over the last decade of what works well. So in our experience, that is really prompt follow-up, engagement directly with the site, making sure that you're handing over the patient contact details to the right person at the site, and then also pre-screening them. So we talk to them for about half an hour each after an online pre-screener, so we make sure that they understand not only what the protocol is and whether they're suitable, but whether they're prepared to make that commitment of 6 months, 2 years, 3 years sometimes, you know, the travel, are they going to be compensated? All those things for their travel, all those things. In our experience, that pre-screening call is super important to maintain that trust and that handover to the site. So I think it's still early days for pharma, even though it makes absolute sense to go direct to the patient, because who is the driver of change in rare disease? It's really the patient or the carer, not the clinician. And we know of patients who've told us that they're sitting in front of the investigator for a particular trial, and the investigator hasn't mentioned the trial because, you know, they're busy, they're tired at the end of the day, you know, they have a lot on their plate. So even though it makes sense for the driver of change to be the patient or carer, it doesn't mean the industry is going to do it, like we're seeing with decentralized trials now. I mean, it's made sense for it, you know, for decades, but it's taken a pandemic to actually get us to change our habits.
Yeah. I think what's interesting too is, like you were saying, it's a last mile problem. Just kind of going back to your first comments around how to get the patients in the studies, because this is one of the issues that we see all the time. You know, as a CRO, we do a lot of studies in rare disease. We do a lot of rescue studies in rare disease. And we come across instances all the time where an advocacy group or, you know, a company, you know, like Experiome is engaged to go and find patients. But if you don't have what you said that you have, which is that handholding, you know, actually talking to the patients, engage, keeping them engaged, being responsive on that handover to the site, all you have is just a number on a paper or your initials on a paper, but you don't have a patient in the study at the end of the day. And I think that's where sponsors are facing. That's why enrollment has been, you know, such a problem and continues to be a problem, because it's a last mile issue. So it sounds like what you guys are doing at Experiome is similar to some of the things we've tried to implement here at BioRassi. We have something called a patient navigator group, which is basically just that. When we look through databases from registries, we get, potentially we could get some patients from Raremark's site, and then we would have that handholding to get them to the site. Because you're right, if they're left to their own devices, the site doesn't know these patients, you know, so, you know, at least the clinical, you know, the clinical study site doesn't know these patients. So, you know, they don't have that engagement and investment in it like the sponsor, like you and like the CRO does. So I think that's really interesting. What I kind of want to explore next is something, you know, that we had kind of briefly touched upon when we spoke before, which was about this whole issue of, are we doing this wrong? Are we doing this entire process wrong for rare diseases? Because I'll just give you a metric, for example, you know, rare disease trials are 60% more likely to face major recruitment delays than normal trials. And we know that normal trials face recruitment delays all the time. So the fact that rare disease is even 60% worse in terms of recruitment issues really speaks to maybe there's a different way we need to do these trials. And clinical development has been designed, right, from the 80s around blockbuster drugs, you know, in conditions with millions of people suffering. That's how we design clinical trials. We write a protocol, we find sites, we initiate them, we get the regulatory approvals, then we expect that the sites are already seeing patients and we just wait for the patients to enroll, right? But with a rare disease, when we do that exact same thing with rare disease, we write a protocol, we find sites, the sites tell us they have the patients, then we initiate the study, and then what happens, right? Like nothing, right? Nothing happens.
For 18 months.
Yeah, sometimes for months, sometimes for years, and then they have to get the study rescued or transition or go to a different venue and wait again. And luckily, some of them complete, but a lot of them never complete, and the trials get halted and canned. I guess my question is, you know, which is a big question, you know, how do we do this differently for rare diseases?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, if I was the sponsor, I would find the patients first. Mm-hmm. Patients first, sites second. So where are they? Where are the patients? I mean, they're findable and they want to be found. And I think the great insight is that there are patients who are not, I mean, I absolutely agree, you know, you leverage whatever resources you can, EMR records, insurance claims databases, patient registries, everything. map that first, patient communities, map that first, and then perhaps overlay, okay, so where's the site specialism? And then match that rather than find the site and then, because as we all know, the investigator is going to say, oh yeah, I've got many of those patients, but you know, 6 months in, they haven't recruited anybody. So patients first, I would say, in this new digital age, and almost have that holding pen of patients ready, consented to find out about trials, willing. I mean, they will tell you, they can't tell pharma, but they can tell a third party, you know, how old I am, what drugs am I on, how long since starting, like, and you can figure it out.
Yeah, I think the opportunity now is like within in the digital age, the ability that, you know, companies like yours that have direct access to patients, you might even call them patient brokers in some way, right? Like a third party company, you know, that has the identified patients there so that, you know, you're not going and identifying them, you know, as John, but you're identifying them as a, as an eligible patient. And I mean, I think there's something there. I mean, these rare disease studies aren't big, you know, they sometimes have, you know, 80 patients in the phase three or less, you know, so it doesn't seem ridiculous to say what you just said. Like, why can't we just go find those 80 patients, get them consented theoretically and into the study, right? Already get their support that they understand the protocol, you know, understand the synopsis at least. Maybe we don't even finalize the protocol because we also want their input on that, right? So we kind of give them the synopsis, they understand it, we get the feedback. Obviously, if we need 80, we identify, you know, 150 or something like that, because we know there's going to get some follow up from screen failures. And I mean, I'll tell you one example is, you know, we had just at a site, the site had 10 patients that they had identified, and this was just at the beginning of the study. By the time that we initiated the site and they started enrolling, they enrolled one, right? Okay, why? Well, they had three that fell out because of screen failures. They actually had two patients that were deceased by the time we started the study. So this was a disease that was unfortunately, you know, had a high mortality rate. They had two patients that went on to another drug that then was, you know, exclusionary. And then, you know, finally, at the end of the day, they enrolled one patient. So you're going to have all of those issues still if you have pre-identified patients. So you do need to identify them early. But I mean, I'm with you. I don't see any strong reasons why you couldn't go and really identify at least a very large subset of what you need so that you're not in the position of, you know, hurrying up to get these sites initiated and then you're just waiting and you're just waiting on the first patient. And like you said, it could be months and or years between patients, and all that time, all that money, it's just going down the drain, you know, and all that time. And there's no drugs getting approved to help the patients, and no patients getting treated with your, you know, product. Right. So,
I think the trend that we see time and time again is, of course, everything you've said is absolutely right. And there's also this kind of inbuilt optimism. Like, they'll look at the stats and they'll know that 60% of rare disease trials fail to recruit. But my trial is going to be fine. So if you're talking to clinical operations, of course, there's going to be that optimism and they're absolutely doing their best. But sometimes it takes the CEO of a, you know, mid-sized cap pharma company with three or four shots on goal in the clinic, or maybe a chief business officer or a strategic corporate officer who kind of is above corporate, above clinical, and says, okay, I'm prepared. I am going to put my neck on the line. I am going to take the risk because it's too risky for ClinOps to make that decision. It's above them, where somebody makes the decision that I will take responsibility for whether this works or not. And I think this trial, before we even start, we are going to do something different. Like, do all the same stuff, you know, do your site identification and so on. But let's try, even as a first step, let's try and add this into the mix. Like, if we plan this in for the first time, like, what would happen? But what we often see is what sponsors do is they say, okay, that sounds really interesting, but I think my trial's going to be fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. When's your first patient in? we were going to do it, like, you know, it was supposed to be 6 months ago and we haven't got any in yet, but I mean, we're feeling confident. Okay. Right.
Yeah. We have new projections and they show us skyrocketing into the future.
It's skyrocketing. should we touch base in 6 months? Okay. Yeah, let's do that. So we touch base in 6 months and how it's going. Well, it's picking up a bit. Okay. Yeah.
It is. And it's so always picking up, right? but you're right. I mean, it is the case where, yeah, either they think their trial is gonna be different, you know, or, you know, it really is just too much boat rocking to do it any other way. I mean, it really is, I think, gonna take a special entrepreneurial company plus probably CRO combination, you know, because, you know, we might take both of them being entrepreneurial to say, you know, we're just really going to try something different. And it's really, I think it's not so different as maybe it sounds. I mean, it really is, you're just kind of flipping, you know, two major efforts around, right? Instead of focusing on trial mobilization and getting all the IRB approvals and getting, you know, out to select sites and all the things that happen in the beginning of a trial, you know, and all the study plans, all this kind of stuff. You're really just, you're doing your synopsis and then you're just going straight to patients and you're saying, let's go identify the patients. And then once you've identified patients, you do all the other things you normally did. So maybe you are just doing that ahead of time. It may not be so crazy that, you know, people can't conceive it, but I guess if there's any sponsors listening to this and entrepreneurial groups listening to this, you know, we should try it together.
Absolutely. And you could call it patient feasibility. Mm-hmm. Like the board understand that. Right. Your directors would understand patient, like we do site feasibility. Why don't we just do patient feasibility at the same time?
Yeah. I mean, it does seem to be a risk.
And then bring all that data together.
Yeah. It seems to be a risk mitigation strategy, certainly, because that feasibility effort will, if that fails, well, thank God, you know, I didn't go and initiate 10 sites to learn that failed, or 50 sites or 100 sites. So I think that's really good. So that's all great. I want to also pivot a little bit. I want to talk a little about RareMark and how you might be using that for collection of data, you know, from those patient populations to inform maybe trials. So a little background on why I'm asking, right? So one of the big things with rare disease studies is because there's every patient is so valuable, right? Why would you want to put any one of them on a placebo, for example, right? Because number one, the patients don't want to be on placebo, most of them, unless maybe they want to get pregnant or something like that. But, you know, most of the patients don't want to be on placebo. They want to be on the active ingredient. And, you know, you want as many people in your treatment group because that's how you're going to show your efficacy. So this is kind of where now natural history studies come in, right? So people want to collect data around the patient population to understand what's the disease progression over time in the population, because this is a rare disease, we don't have a lot of data, and then maybe compare that as a historical control to patients in the study. Is that something that you guys are looking at leveraging in the future of RareMark or even in the present?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, most of our work right now is accelerating recruitment, mm-hmm. and then post-approval, finding patients for the drug. So even once the new treatment is marketed, it doesn't mean that pharma can find them. They're still relying on clinicians to find the patients, whereas mm-hmm. the patients are still desperately searching online for treatment. And so we can educate the patient, mm-hmm. not by the standard drug advertising, but by educational webinars around how do I know that this treatment might be right for me. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where we're seeing most of the growth. I absolutely agree with the kind of opportunity for a virtual trial control arm, mm-hmm. but the sponsors that are coming to us and the conversations that we're having right now are more around accelerating recruitment. Decentralized trials is the mm-hmm. big theme that we're seeing. Huge interest from sponsors and a lot of conversations with the CROs positioning in that space.
So when you say decentralized trials, do you mean actually site-less trials, like where they're trying to get patients from the RareMark Experium community to potentially then have them connected to a virtual site? Is that what they're doing?
Yes,
or are
exactly.
they just trying to
exactly. Okay. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, it's the future of decentralized trials, I'm sure will come. And most trials will become decentralized where they can. What's really happening in practice is that where it makes sense, some of the lab work is being done at home. Mm. So for some trials, that might just be doing the blood draw at home as opposed to going into a doctor's office. But the sponsors very much want this to happen. One of the limitations that we're seeing is that for some trials where the sponsor really wants to do it, and the CRO really wants to do it, and we just feed the patients in. It doesn't matter to us whether they're going to a bricks and mortar, or whether they're going to a meta site, or whether they're being seen at home. The recruitment process is the same. You're obviously going to get a lot more engagement if the patient doesn't have to travel and the patient burden is low. You're going to get a lot more pickup. So that one of the challenges is the validation of the measures. So if the endpoint isn't validated to be done at home, then the sponsor is going to hesitate. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're seeing in the market, is that lack of a validated measure as holding it back. But we're seeing a lot of sponsor interest in making that happen. That's the big trend that we're seeing.
Mm. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Seems like, though, that would be something that they would know by the time they came to you, right? To get patients, they would know whether or not they could support that trial in a decentralized manner.
They're still, right? We're now starting to see sponsors go, okay, we're just going to build this direct to patient recruitment into the kickoff. Right? We haven't started yet. And so some of the protocols are still being finalized.
Yeah,
the implementation of it, you know, is still being finalized. They may have approval to go ahead, but they're still trying to figure out, like, can we do some of this in a decentralized way? And we say, look, we're here, we've got the patients, you know, you let us know where, you know, what their options are, and we'll talk it through with them. Obviously, if you can do it at home, that's going to get so much more engaged.
Yeah.
But if you have to say you've got to travel over state lines and spend a night in a hotel with your family, like, that's just, you know, for many, it's just too hard.
Yeah, I mean, and I think this is an area where the innovation is, again, somewhat tempered by, you know, the uptake and by what's really possible. Because like you said, you could do a lot of things at home, but like in our experience, we've had a lot of trials with rare diseases where, sure, we could do 50% of the assessments at home, but this is an IV. This is something that just requires an imaging, you know, that requires the patient to come in. And so, you know, when you have elements of that protocol, which, you know, most of these protocols have at least a couple of elements that just have to be done in the clinic, maybe 10 years from now, it won't be the case, right? We'll have the technologies where they could actually do those at home. But right now we're, you know, you're forced into this hybrid situation. And then unfortunately, then you don't get the benefits of either, right? You don't really get the full benefits of being decentralized with, you know, less patient burden, but still, you know, and lower costs and, you know, quicker turnaround times and faster responses, better compliance.
Yes.
And yet you don't really get the full benefits of completely in person, which is that, you know, really good oversight of the safety and actually good compliance as well, because everything they're doing is in the clinic. You have to worry about training, you know, things like that, or, you know, Bluetooth devices going haywire or whatever else that happens when you start to put people on people's wrists and things. But right now we're seeing that so much of the decision is, you know, do I keep it kind of traditional or do I go hybrid? And we've had a lot of people just selecting just to go traditional if you can. Now you're right. Of course, Corona has changed all of that because, you know, we've just had to go completely digital. We're trying to innovate. Like you said, you can only innovate so far because you have to still consider the practice, you know, and the adoption.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, with pharma, the one thing I've learned is that it's never a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
It's always an evolution.
Yeah.
It's too much money at stake. Mm-hmm. It's too much investment. It's too much at risk. So I think we'll see it evolving. But at least sponsors are being cognizant now, at least thinking about, what could we do? I mean, that conversation wasn't even happening 10 years ago. So what could we do at home? At least that conversation is now happening. And I think over time, we'll see it evolve to where it's more sensible.
Yeah.
Because it's just not patient friendly. So many of them are just not.
We've talked about a lot of, you know, a lot of issues that we've seen in rare disease, how we might approach it differently. What are we missing? You know, like in your experience, you know, working with these patient communities directly and seeing what they've had to say and listening and talking to them about topics that probably no one's ever asked some of these patients before. Can you think of something that, like, as an industry, we have just missed, or where's our blind spot here with rare diseases?
That's a great question. I think it's something around leadership in pharma. I think it's something around taking risks in development in a very managed way. So a risk around thinking about doing it slightly differently. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry, we've seen through the development of the coronavirus vaccines. I mean, when they have to, they can absolutely knock it out of the park. And I think it's thinking around, you know, that energy, that super energy, that super innovation in research, bringing that, some of that into development so that we do it differently. Because the patients, a lot of the conversations that we have around, well, you know, how you consent people and do people want to be asked? And as a friend of mine who has cystic fibrosis and who's had a double lung transplant, when he's asked by a clinician or a nurse, do you mind if we use your data for research purposes? He says, of course. How could you not? How could you not use my data to improve the lives of people like me? So I think thinking about it from, they want us to take their experience. They want us to use and leverage their lives and their struggles to innovate. And that's what I would like to see more of. I think, you know, taking a chance. I'm not saying that we should be careless, but I think that we should be thoughtful about trying new things in development to accelerate these treatments, because there are 7,000 rare diseases, only 10% have treatments. The 90% that have nothing, the FDA is approving 20 to 30 rare disease drugs a year. We had hundreds of years to reach, hundreds, like something has got to accelerate. So I think it's a responsibility on all of us to think differently.
I totally agree. I think that's really good insight. It seems to also come back to that, you know, we've built an industry, an approach that was made for big indications. And, you know, we got used to that. And in fact, we have now regulations that sort of support around that from all perspectives. And I know that the FDA has really done a good job about issuing a lot of guidance actually around rare disease and how we might utilize and be more efficient in data. So I think they're willing to accept things, right? But they're not going to be the innovators. I mean, by definition, they cannot be the innovators. So really it is incumbent on us, you know, and sponsors and CROs, people like yourself, the entrepreneurs, to take a little bit of a leap, you know, and say, this is different. It's a different type of research. We should be willing and excited about trying some different approaches and invest a little bit in that. So I'm totally with you there. We're not going to disagree on that for sure.
Yeah, for sure. 100%. 100%.
Julie, it's been a great conversation. I want, before we kind of close, where for patients that might be listening or patients' families, you know, where can they find, where can they engage with you and with Raremark?
If you just Google Raremark, we'll come up. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram. Yeah, if you just Google us, you'll find us. And I just wish that we could help more rare diseases, but we do have a list, you know, of ones that. And if people say, please look at, you know, Friedreich's ataxia, please look at Huntington's, you know, we do keep those and we do keep in touch. So, you know, we're very empathetic. We have patient advocates on our team. So, we stand in their shoes. So we're coming as quickly as we can.
Great. No, that's really wonderful. Well, I appreciate all the good work you're doing there, Julie. And hopefully we'll work together soon on a study for sure. And definitely we'll keep in touch.
Great. Pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for everything you're doing.
Yes, thank you, Julie. If you enjoyed this podcast or have suggestions for future episodes and how we can make it better, please get in touch with us. You can email us at fewandfarbetween@biorassi.com or contact us at our website at biorassi.com.